I am with Lauren Gershuni, coordinator of the Canadian Lawyers Committee in support of the anti-terrorist Cuban Five based in Toronto. Lauren is also active with the Canadian chapter of the Korean Truth Commission. As such, she has participated in the Canadian delegation to the 8th International Fact-Finding Mission of the Korean Truth Commission in 2001. And he has also taken on several political cases in his legal practice defending members of grassroots political groups, such as the Anti-Racist Action. Thanks for joining me today for the interview, Lauren.
Thank you.
Can you give a brief introduction to listeners who don't know who the Cuban Five are?
The Cuban Five are five Cuban men who were sent on a mission by the Cuban government to gather information about the plans and activities of violent terrorist anti-Cuban groups who have carried out many attacks over the decades against Cuba and Cuban targets from U.S. territory, with the aim of trying to crush and overthrow the revolutionary government of Cuba. They went there to gather information about these groups' plans in order to assist the Cuban government in protecting Cuba and the Cuban people from any further terrorist attacks being launched against Cuba. So their aim was not to try to spy on the U.S. or to gather sensitive national security or national defense information, but that's what they were accused of doing in 1998. The Cuban government provided the information that they had gathered about these terrorist groups to the FBI, and instead of stopping and arresting those violent terrorists, they arrested five Cubans and put them on trial for allegedly spying against the U.S., which was a false accusation.
Can you give a brief outline on the legal issues since they were arrested 12 years ago on September 12th? And can you share the latest updates on the case?
Well, after a biased trial, which was done in a circus atmosphere of hysteria against them in Miami, they were convicted of all counts against them, including the espionage-related charges, and given extremely lengthy sentences, particularly when you compare that to other cases of alleged spies who were proven to have given thousands of documents to the U.S. government to foreign powers. These five Cubans were given very lengthy sentences, even though it was never shown that they ever gave one piece of sensitive national security information to their government. They were only trying to get information about the activities of these violent terrorist anti-Cuban groups. Their case has gone through a number of appeals. Just to give you a time frame in terms of dates, they were arrested in September 1998, and their trial didn't begin until January 2001. And even though it lasted 6 months, there was never any proof that they actually stole any top-secret information or that they did anything to commit espionage against the United States. However, in June of 2001, the verdict came down, convicting them on all those counts. Their first appeal wasn't even heard till 2004, and then it was 18 months after that, in late 2005, that the decision was even handed down on their first appeal, which was quite dramatic because it exposed in a lengthy judgment all the outrageous steps that have been taken by the adherents of these groups to taint the trial and to intimidate the jurors in particular, and to threaten them that if they didn't bring a verdict of guilty, that they might be in trouble of being a target of these groups. They wrote down the license plates of jurors' cars, they videotaped them coming and going. The judge even had to have the jurors park at a separate place across town and be bused back and forth so that they wouldn't be subject to surveillance by these reactionary groups. Even in the face of all that, the trial went ahead. The appeal decision in 2005 gave many examples of this kind of jury intimidation and said that it was wrong to hold that trial in Miami. It should have been moved to another location where there wasn't such a poisoned atmosphere against anybody associated with the Cuban government, and that the verdicts should simply be overruled and they should have a new trial. The government wasn't satisfied with that. They appealed that, and eventually they got a ruling overruling that. So from 1998 to date, they still have not been released from prison. Their further appeals didn't result in any other positive steps towards their immediate release anyway. The only concessions that were achieved were in late 2009, which was 11 years after their arrest. Three of them were resentenced because the appeal court found that they had been given excessive sentences according to the sentencing guidelines in the United States federal criminal system. And that could be significant because two of those have been given life sentences, which is very onerous in the federal criminal law system in the United States because they've eliminated parole entirely. If you have a life sentence there, you never get out. You're not entitled to parole at any time. And if you have a sentence of a term of years, you're entitled to earn 15% credit for good behavior. So on the appeal, the two of them, who had previously been given life sentences, had their sentences reduced to a term of years, which means that sometime in the future, still an outrageous amount of time to spend in jail, but sometime they would have a release date. In addition to that, the person who had received the lightest, if you could call it light, sentence originally, Rene Gonzalez, he was given a sentence of 15 years, and if he's given his 15% credit, he may actually be eligible for release sometime in the middle of next year, 2011. So that's how far the appeals have gotten. They did request an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court of the entire case, but earlier this year, that was denied without any reasons being given.
Can you give more details on what is the basis of the sentences of the Cuban Five? Antonio Guerrero, Ramon Labanino, Geraldo Hernandez, Rene Gonzalez, and Fernando Gonzalez. What is the basis of their sentences and the ongoing denial of their freedom, like their appeals in the court system?
Well, the basis for charging them was the false pretext that they were there in Southern Florida to attack the interests of the U.S., by stealing and communicating top-secret information that would reveal national security secrets or national defense secrets of the United States. And there never was any proof that they did that. So the charge brought against them was not literally that they stole that information, but against three of them, it was that they conspired to do that. Now, where the charge is conspiracy, you don't actually have to prove that anybody actually accomplished what they set out to do. All you have to prove is that they formed an agreement to do that illegal thing, and that by looking at the evidence should conclude that they must have been planning to do that thing, which was illegally collect information about the national security of the United States. So three of them had that charge against them, conspiracy to commit espionage. And, of course, they were convicted on all counts. And it was those who were convicted of that who received the life sentences, two of which were later commuted to a term of years. So that was really what was behind the prosecution. It was to take revenge on these people who had come and successfully gathered information about homegrown terrorists on U.S. territory who the U.S. wanted to keep as a reserve to possibly keep launching further attacks against Cuba in furtherance of their aggressive policy against them, but to deny that that was really U.S. policy under the hopes that, well, these people were here not to gather information about terrorist service on U.S. policy, they were here to steal U.S. national security. That was the hoax under which this whole prosecution was done. You were asking what was the basis of the actual sentences? So that was roughly it. The heaviest sentences were given to those who were charged with conspiracy to commit espionage. There was an additional charge against Gerardo Hernandez, which was added months after their arrest, of conspiracy to commit murder. But again, there was actually no basis in the evidence or in past U.S. law for that. The accusation against him was that the murder that he conspired to commit was the shooting down of two airplanes sent by one of these terrorist groups in 1996 at the time that they were threatening to violate Cuban airspace and had been warned not to do so because, sadly, four people died in that incident. which was an occasion of a country, Cuba, using their own air force to defend their airspace against airplanes, which they had previously told the U.S. government should not be allowed to come. Those airplanes of that group had done overflights of Cuba before, and the Cubans were not going to tolerate having their people and their territory put at risk by any further planes flying over them. So when this group, Brothers to the Rescue, tried that again, two of the three planes were shot down. The third plane, which was actually piloted by the leader of that group, turned around, went back, and he saved himself. He wasn't shot down. The charge of conspiracy to commit murder against Gerardo Hernandez was that he conspired with the Cuban government to shoot down these planes, which was obviously false. He didn't know in advance that they were going to do that. It wasn't something that the Cuban government had planned. Plus, there's no way that under any international law you can say that that was a murder that was committed. It was an occasion of a sovereign country defending their own airspace against planes which they had previously warned the U.S. Should not be sent into their territory, and that they would take measures to stop it. Even though no proof was given that he was guilty of that count, still, in the biased atmosphere of the trial, he was convicted on that count as well. And neither of those life sentences against him, either for a conspiracy to commit espionage or a conspiracy to commit murder, have been reduced by the courts. So he is still facing no prospects of parole in the prison where he is being held in California.
Can you expand on a little bit about why others had different sentences? Because each of the falsely accused Cuban five, they each have different sentences.
Right. If you take the example of the two who did not have conspiracy charges against them, they were charged with acting as an unregistered agent of a foreign country, which is another law in the U.S. against agents who are spying, essentially, on the U.S. And they received terms of years, not life sentences. René González received 15 years. So if he is allowed to earn his 15% credit under their system, he may actually be eligible to be released sometime in the middle of 2011. Fernando González, who was also convicted of being an unregistered agent of a foreign government, he originally received 19 years, and that was reduced to 17 years, 9 months. So he will also have some release date, a number of years in the future. It's still too long, but his was one of the sentences reduced on appeal. So they weren't all charged with the identical set of charges, so there was variation among them. The stiffest sentences were given to the ones with the espionage charges, and then of course Gerardo with the double life sentence because they had the conspiracy to commit murder charge against him. The reduction of the sentences for three of them resulted because the court that heard their appeal against their sentences agreed that for two of them, two that had received the life sentences, they really shouldn't have received a maximum because there was no proof that they had actually stolen top secret information, which is a factor under their guidelines determining how stiff the sentence should be. So they had their sentences reduced accordingly because it was pointed out that it was never proven that they had received top secret information. For Fernando González, it was pointed out that he should not have received such a lengthy term of years in his sentence because he was not I think they call it manager or supervisor. And within their sentencing guidelines, that's also what they call an enhancement of the sentence if that factor had been proven. But it wasn't, so his sentence was also referred back for reduction after the appeal court pointed out that he'd been given an excessive sentence on his charge, even though there was no proof that he was actually a leader in all this. So those were the formal legal reasons given for reducing those three sentences.
Are those the latest updates on the changes of the legal standing of each?
Those resentencings were done last fall, fall of 2009, after they had all been in jail for 11 years.
Was it in the recent year that a revealing of the names of journalists and the payment amounts and notebooks highlighting articles and propaganda by supposedly independent journalists were exposed, that they were covertly on the payroll of the U.S. government? Was that in the recent year?
I believe the Freedom of Information request was made around 2006, but it was within the last year that documents were revealed showing that certain journalists had actually been paid by the U.S. government to write biased and inflammatory articles to the prejudice of the five Cubans who were on trial. These articles were written before in the period preceding the trial as well as during the trial. And they certainly would have had the effect of prejudicing the potential jury pool of people who were going to serve in the trial against them by inflaming opinion against anybody associated with the Cuban government and characterizing them as spies who came there to harm the interests of the United States, which was not true. So based on that information, the lawyers for four of them, probably, have now launched what they call a habeas corpus application in the U.S. system to have the entire trial process overturned and the convictions quashed. Because there is now clear proof that the venue of the trial should have been moved away from Miami, where these inflammatory news items were disseminated on a prejudicial basis. So that case has now been started. The defendants was presented apparently in October, and the U.S. Attorney's Office was given 60 days to respond, which should be any day now, that their deadline is coming up. And once that's done, they will set a date for an actual hearing on that question. And hopefully they can get some relief through the legal avenues that way.
The Cuban Five's counsel for defense, they did go to the U.S. Supreme Court and they exhausted the appeals process. And so this is their last resort. This is after they tried everything. And so what happens if this process is successful?
Well, what they're asking for in this latest application to the court is for a declaration that they did not receive a fair trial because the venue should have been changed to a place outside of Miami, and therefore the guilty verdicts should be overturned and the whole matter should be referred for a new trial outside of Miami.
Talk about the trial being in Miami, the reasons why it was kept in Miami.
Well, the lawyers for the defense brought numerous motions at the actual trial in 2001 to ask that it be moved even 40 miles away to Fort Lauderdale, and they presented compelling evidence, particularly from surveys done by a university professor in Florida, which showed that there was a strong prevailing sentiment among the community in Miami, particularly to do with any case that involved any agents of the Cuban government. And those arguments were rejected. The trial judge decided that she had done enough of lengthy inquiry into the attitudes of each potential juror to ensure that they were not biased, and the general reason for keeping it in Miami was that Miami is a large, diverse metropolitan community, and that these particular attitudes that may be prevalent in one part of the community could be filtered out through the jury selection process. So she rejected the idea that there was a pervasive community prejudice that had been worsened by all the sensationalist propaganda describing these people as spies against the United States. When it went to that first appeal, it was quite a dramatic reversal, because that appeal, which was 93 pages long in its written judgment, it gave many, many examples of not only the pervasive community prejudice, but the jury intimidation, which showed, like, beyond doubt that it was clearly a case that should have been moved to a different venue, the Miami, in order to have a fair trial. and the whole atmosphere of prejudice against them, which was done outside the courtroom, definitely affected the result.
Talk about Luis Posada and the latest news about his case.
Okay. As your listeners may know, Luis Posada Carriles is one of the most notorious terrorist criminals who has been carrying out and organizing violent criminal attacks against Cuba or Cuban targets for almost 50 years now, since the failure of the Bay of Pigs. He was originally an exile from Cuba who joined the American government forces, was trained in explosives, and may have actually spent time in Vietnam during the U.S. war of aggression there. And he was for a time also a CIA operative and was used to commit subversion against Cuba and the whole sphere of Latin America. For a time, he was also involved in the secret intelligence division of the Venezuelan government at a time when it was very reactionary, and terrible incidents of torture were carried out against Venezuelans at that time, who were part of the revolutionary movement there. He was also involved in munitions or other material supply for the Contra War against Nicaragua during the Reagan administration. But he's most notorious for being really one of the masterminds behind the outrageous blowing up of the civilian Cubana airliner in 1976, which killed 73 innocent passengers. He was about to be brought before the courts on the final day of a trial in Venezuela, where the verdict would be pronounced against him, but his release was secretly bought by funneling money from sources in the U.S. to prison authorities in Venezuela, and he managed to escape from jail the day before he was about to face the decision of the courts on that, and that was in 85, I believe. And since then, he continued his notorious activities of carrying out and organizing violent acts designed to cripple and overthrow the Cuban Revolution. In 2000, he was part of a group who were sentenced because of their participation in a plot to blow up a university speaking hall where Cuban President Fidel Castro was about to speak on the occasion of the Ibero-American summit that was taking place in Panama at the time. Luckily, through the assistance of Cuban intelligence, they managed to thwart that bomb plot, and the participants were arrested and put in jail. However, they spent, I believe, 4 years in jail, but just before the president of Panama was about to finish her term, Moscoso, and she and the American authorities knew that the incoming president might very well extradite Posada back to Venezuela to stand trial for the crime that he never did complete his trial for there. The president of Panama, Moscoso, on the instructions of the U.S. embassy, essentially, contrived to pardon all of them and release them from jail and allow them to leave Panama. So he was allowed to escape extradition that way. He left Panama and eventually resurfaced in the United States, where he gave a false explanation for how he had come to the United States. He claimed that he had entered the U.S. in El Paso, Texas, at the border there, and had then taken a bus to Miami. In fact, he had been brought directly to Florida on a boat from some of his terrorist compatriots from Mexico. Initially, he was then charged with immigration violations, not charged with what he should have been charged with, and the U.S. government refused or has yet to respond to a request to extradite him to Venezuela. At his immigration hearing, he brought evidence from someone who used to work with him in the Secret Intelligence Bureau in Venezuela, who falsely testified that if he was returned to Venezuela, he might face torture at the hands of either the Venezuelan authorities or if he were sent to Cuba by the Cuban authorities. Therefore, the U.S. court refused to deport him to either Venezuela or Cuba, and washed their hands of it and said, well, you know, those are the only countries that will take him, so we can't do anything about it. We can't deport him, and we won't. Most recently, the U.S. Attorney's Office brought charges against him for perjury based on the fact that he lied at his initial immigration interview, not only about how he arrived in the U.S., but also in denying that he had anything to do with the series of bomb explosions that were carried out in Havana hotels in 1997, even though he had admitted to them in a publicized interview with the New York Times reporter when she spoke to him in 1998. Initially, that charge of perjury was thrown out by the judge in El Paso, saying that he had been tricked by the immigration authorities and had not been provided proper interpreting services, flimsy grounds like that. The U.S. government appealed that decision. They won that appeal, so the charges were reinstated, and they are now preparing to actually put him on trial on the charge of perjury, not mass murder like he would be facing if he were rightly returned to Venezuela, but perjury for having lied when he denied any responsibility for the bombings in Havana. And they intend to bring this evidence of what he admitted to the New York Times reporter, as well as from officials in Cuba who were responsible for capturing the people that he had hired to do this and who got admissions from them about who had hired him to do this, where the money came from, who paid it, and things like that. So that trial, after many delays, is apparently set to go ahead 1 month from now, starting January 10, 2011. So if anybody is going to be passing through El Paso, Texas, on January 10th, please join in the protest demonstration that's going to be held outside the courthouse at the beginning of his trial.
How has the Canadian government helped prop up the conviction, the charges, the incarceration of the Cuban guy?
The Canadian government has helped prop it up by maintaining silence about the fact that these known terrorist violent criminals, such as Posada and Orlando Bosch, have been allowed to simply walk free and actually be toasted by people of their ilk in Miami, in the case of Orlando Bosch, for years. Even though when he originally came there himself in the late 90s, the Justice Department said that he should be refused entry because he's such a well-known, dangerous terrorist criminal, yet the Bush White House overruled that and allowed him to enter and remain as a resident of the United States. And he's still here, and he still makes public statements justifying his participation in the mass murder of the people on the Cuban Airlines. He goes on TV talking about how this was a justifiable act of war and that his participation in it was justified. The Canadian government has maintained a complete silence about the fact that the U.S. is a country that harbors terrorist criminals on its own territory and has done so for decades and has, organized and protected them, allowed them to be financed through state funds, really, and allowed them to carry out numerous terrorist attacks against Cuba. At the same time that the U.S. government goes around the world attempting to justify its aggressions on the basis that they're only going there to root out those who harbor terrorists. And in fact, that was the excuse that the Karachay government gave in the first place for enlisting Canadian military forces to join in the American invasion of Afghanistan, that it was necessary to get rid of those who harbor terrorists on their territory. So the Canadian government has completely joined in this fraudulent pretext of the war on terrorism that the American government uses fraudulently around the world to justify its aggression, but says nothing about the actual violent terrorist criminals that the U.S. government harbors on its own territory.
I think that's really important that you mentioned that intentional hypocrisy, and that touches upon the political significance of the case of the Cuban Five here in Canada and worldwide. Would you want to expand on the significance of the case of the Cuban Five?
Well, I think that's right, that the significance for us is that these five Cubans who were falsely arrested for being spies, through their activity and through the principal stand that they took at the trial, exposing the activity of these terrorist groups, and by putting forward the true position, which was that they were there simply to try to prevent any further attacks by these groups, that has been a powerful assistance to all of us around the world who are facing this fraudulent pretext of war on terrorism that the governments of the U.S., Canada, and its allies are using to try to enlist their own people in their unjust activities. So by standing up, by refusing to admit that what they did was wrong, when it was right to stand up for the sovereignty of their own countries, by refusing to plead guilty when in fact they're not guilty of any crime, it's not a crime to try to prevent these further attacks against their own country, and by forcing this to go to a trial where they took every opportunity, even though they were restricted from doing so, to point out that it is the U.S. that harbors terrorist criminals on its territory, and it was completely unjust for them to be treated as criminals. So right up to today, it's still a just demand for everybody around the world, all of peace-loving humanity, to support the demand that they should be released immediately from U.S. prisons because they're being held there unjustly. They're not guilty of any crime. It is not wrong to devote your life to
standing up
for the sovereignty of your people and your homeland.
Yeah. Sovereignty of your honorable.
Yes, this is an honorable stand for which, you know, they could have simply avoided any responsibility. They could have taken a legal route that would have been lighter on themselves. But no, they stood up for principle and refused to renounce their defense of sovereignty and refused to stop exposing who are the real terrorists. So in doing that, they are our brothers. They're providing powerful assistance to us. We support them in their struggle and in their demand that they should not be treated as criminals, because they're not. They're helping us in our struggle to try to keep Canada out of war, to withdraw Canadian forces from where they are carrying out unjust military aggression alongside their U.S. allies. And for that, you know, we support them.
How can Canadians support the efforts to stop injustices inflicted upon these five men? Antonio Guerrero, Ramon Labanino, Geraldo Hernandez, Rene Gonzalez, and Fernando Gonzalez.
Well, do what you can to keep up on the developments in the case. Right now, the National Committee to Free the Five in the U.S. is called on 5 days from now, which is International Human Rights Day, to December 15th, where people around the world are called on to send their messages directly to President Obama in the White House, whether it's through phone calls, emails, telegrams, postcards, any way that they can express their outrage at the fact that they are still held in prison, and demanding that he use his powers of executive privilege to free them immediately and allow them to return home to Cuba so that this continued injustice against them will be ended right away. So you can look for the information about that on the website of the National Committee in the United States, freethefive.org, I think it is. And anything that anybody can do to add their voices to that will be helpful, because at this stage of things, other than the habeas corpus application that's still in progress, the legal appeals avenues, to all intents and purposes, have been tried and exhausted. So it's through public support and public opinion being exerted on the U.S. authorities that might result in a change in doing that. That's where the efforts are being directed these days.
Thank you so much for taking the time to share your time to educate listeners about this whole 15-5 case.
You're very welcome.
I was just speaking with Lauren Gershuni, coordinator of the Canadian Lawyers Committee in support of the anti-terrorist Cuban 5 based in Toronto. Lauren is also active with the Canadian chapter of the Korean Truth Commission. As such, she has participated in the Canadian delegation to the 8th International Fact-Finding Mission of the Korean Truth Commission in 2001.